Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hello, it's Kitty Martone, healthy gut girl, and this is Stuff Your Doctor Should Know. I'm coming to you live from deep inside your large intestine, and I am completely excited about today's podcast because for the fourth time, Georgie Dinkoff is back to join us. This time he is talking about the new sector of Idea Labs, his company Idea Labs, which he offers cosmetic grade nutritional supplements. Is that how I can say that? He has amazing, amazing products that I have used a lot of, and you can certainly check that out in the show notes. But he is now offering, and I think for several months now, has been offering the hair and nail steroid analysis, which is basically a way to test the hormones in the tissues. Okay, so you might have heard me talk about this, or you might have no idea what I'm talking about. But basically, most hormones are tested through urine. There is a 24-hour urine that they can check hormones with, and that is basically called the gold standard right now, which means it is probably the most accurate. I'm not sure if that's the word, especially after having done this interview today with Georgie. Maybe the most thorough might be a better word, because accuracy is not the greatest word, because it really depends from day to day what is going on in your body. So it's really hard to get an accurate reading of your hormones when things fluctuate all the time. And that's what's so exciting about this test, these tests. The other tests are the blood spot, which is like a pinprick, and that can check your hormone levels as well. Then there are saliva labs, which can check cortisol levels, adrenal function, and also hormone levels. And then there is, of course, the dried urine, which is the lab that I work with. And the brand is called Precision Analytical, and that test is called the Dutch, which is dried urine for comprehensive hormone testing. Dried urine testing for comprehensive hormones, right, Dutch. And then that's the Dutch Complete, and then they also offer other forms of the Dutch. Well, what we have been discussing in my estrogen dominance support group, as well as with clients and just in podcasts with doctors and different experts, is the notion that, well, now it's a fact that estrogen does collect in tissue and it can be tested. And as we age and we get into, and this goes for men as well, and we get into our older years, I'm going to say even now from 48 and up, maybe even younger, when hormone levels start to decline and we think that we are low on estrogen, low on progesterone, low on testosterone, so we supplement these things. And the argument has been in the pro-metabolic community that you have to be very careful about supplementing, particularly estrogen, because it does retreat, if you will, into the tissues. When it is not opposed by estrogen, right, when that's the job of progesterone, one of the jobs of progesterone is to oppose estrogen at all times. It's a modulator. It's a regulator. It's an arbiter. It helps. It keeps the estrogen from going rogue and doing too much of what it does naturally, which is causes cells to divide and grow, basically. And so Georgie has come up with this amazing technology, amazing lab, using the hair tissue, nail tissue analysis frame. And from that and his research and a bunch of other science and studies and data, he has come up with this amazing way and has a great database already filled with proof that this is actually the case. And so he's going to talk all about that. But in light of that, I wanted to also just mention before we dig deep is that I did start the Kitty Bloomfield's Win at Life 16-week accelerator program. It sounds so serious. It is serious, let me tell you. And it has been such an interesting journey, such an interesting beginning. It's only been like my 9th or 10th day now. And you don't work out every day, of course. It's just 3 days a week. But tracking my food, I am shocked to find out what I actually am doing to myself, how much I'm under eating, how much I eat too much of the wrong things that I didn't even realize I was doing, and things that you normally would think are really healthy, like fat, right? Like healthy carbohydrates. And it is just a real eye opener. And then just to kind of be my hand being held through this process, of course, virtually, because the coach is not there with me. But just the whole idea of knowing what my recipes are going to be, what I'm going to be eating this week, what it simplifies everything. Talking to my coach a few times a week, all of these things have been incredibly beneficial but shocking. I'm just learning so much. I feel like a baby. Like I'm just brand new to all of this. It's really cool though, because I suspect I'm going to start feeling really good soon, because right now I'm tired. I'm getting in way more steps than I ever have, trying to find ways to fit in lots of steps. And oh, it's definitely like some days I get like 500 steps. And then like yesterday I got 12,000 steps and I worked out in the morning. So I'm going to eventually find a nice balance and I'm looking forward to doing that. But I will talk a little bit more after we talk with Georgie, because I want to talk about all of this and how it all works together. All right. So get out your pen and your paper, because this is the best podcast of all time. So, okay. I've been
you
really
look beautiful, by the way.
Oh, really, thank
like
you.
Radiant. Yeah, I don't know. What happened?
It might be the new lights.
Or maybe less stress. No, you do look different. I don't know.
Thank you. You know, I actually, do you know who Dr. Tyler Panzner is?
Danny mentioned him a few times, but yeah. I don't know him personally.
But he basically takes your genetic info, like from 23andMe, and then he inputs it into Self-Decode. And then from that, he creates a program based on your like top 5 to 10 variants. And I'm telling you, it changed my life. He, you know, it was this, these variants, like I don't absorb and convert and process vitamin D at all, like very well. And then I have these other variants that like, I don't break down adrenaline and I don't have metallothionine, like enough of it. Okay. And so there's all these things that he had me customize my current protocol to. And I mean, I've been on it for 2 months now and I feel like a different person. It's crazy.
You look like a different person.
Thank you. That's awesome. And I'm doing Kitty Bloomfield's program now too. So I'm getting some pump in.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice. Those buff Australians are getting you in shape, right?
I mean, she's a badass. She scares me. But it's good. I need it. I want to go into this next phase of, you know, menopause and everything, just feeling strong and all that good stuff. So, and one of those things is I am super eager to take on what I want to do is I want to do a Dutch. I might have mentioned this to you. I want to do a blood spot. I want to do a full blood panel, and I want to do your steroid analysis. And, I want to just compare all that, and I want to share it in my group and on my podcast and everywhere, because I can feel I'm almost fully in menopause and I can feel the changes where the estrogen is like going into the tissues. I know it is. So I want to do that. And I'm excited to share that with people. So, one of the things that is so common in our group, we're at almost 30,000 people now in the Facebook group, but we're like 85% active. So we've got people just starving to figure out what to do. And if you notice lately, it's like estrogen is being pushed down our throats than I've ever seen since I've been in this space. What gives?
You know why? Yeah. So basically the pharma industry, they never accepted the findings of those massive studies, the Women Health Initiative studies. These were like 10 or 15 different trials that ran for like, I think, at least a decade. And in the early 2000s, when the results came out, basically the trials were conclusive, said you should not give estrogen to any woman, because the groups that took estrogen in any form had basically 7 to 8 times higher rates of heart attacks, strokes, general cardiovascular disease, obesity, which estrogen was supposedly supposed to prevent, right? So basically, these trials were devastating, and they were double-blind, placebo-controlled, randomized trials. So they weren't epidemiological studies. So pharma industry was devastated, said, damn, what are we going to do now? And I think around 2012-ish, 15-ish, and I started seeing these studies come out that basically said, well, we've done some smaller studies with different groups using different dosages and like an administration regimens, and we didn't get anywhere near the same like increase in risk. In fact, we got like reduction in risk. So little by little, pharma, I don't know if they ghostwrite these things or not, but they've been pumping out literature, compromising literature, since 2015-ish. They basically said the women health issue studies, for whatever reason, they don't represent reality, despite the fact that there were really very large trials, hundreds of thousands of women randomly selected and whatnot. And now they're saying whenever we give estrogen to a menopausal woman, she experiences a drastic reduction of symptoms within hours. And that is actually largely true, mostly because estrogen suppresses the pituitary. However, that doesn't address the long-term risk. And basically, if you keep giving estrogen, within a week or so, you're getting into this estrogen dominance. Your symptoms are basically back. But then the doctor says, well, look, if it helped you initially, it can't be the estrogen, right? So it's got to be something else. And they keep giving the estrogen and tweaking the dosage and maybe switching from like ethinyl estradiol to like a patch, which is ethinyl estradiol is the oral one, to a patch or something else, or give you a synthetic progestin to balance the estrogen. But now we know that all these synthetic progestins, most of them, not all of them, are actually estrogenic themselves, right? So they muddied the water significantly, to the point where now most of the doctors that I'm interacting with, when I ask them, okay, what are you doing for a menopausal woman? They're saying, well, to be honest with you, estrogen is back on the table. HRT with estrogen is back on the table. But because we're still afraid of the data from the WHI studies, we're not giving estradiol. We're not giving estrone. We're giving estriol. And estriol is like supposedly the weakest estrogen that is in the body. But it's still, it has about 20% of the strength of estradiol. So it's only, you know, 5 times weaker, still perfectly capable of causing cancer, perfectly capable of causing fibrosis, polycystic ovarian syndrome, fibroids, anything you can imagine, the estrogen, really all of these things that causes, estriol causes them, even though it's supposedly the weakest estrogen. So it's, unfortunately, the field has been compromised, and I think it will take some kind of a drastic study, but I don't think they'll allow it to happen anymore.
No.
They're very controlling now with censorship and everything going on. They have everything under control. Studies like that, Women Health Initiative studies that were funded by the government, massive studies, really in the name of public good and public health, I don't think this with estrogen, I don't think these studies will happen anymore with estrogen. This one study here said this is estrogen is good, and that's the truth. And anybody who says otherwise, we're going to censor the hell out of them out of Twitter or YouTube or whatnot.
I mean, even the whole thing that's been going on talking about medicated birth control protecting the uterus, like this has been, Sarah Gottfried was saying it on, I think it was a podcast, I don't remember with who, and she was going on and on about it being protective for the uterus. And I mean, I didn't watch the whole thing, but someone told me she does mention that it does increase the risk of breast cancer. But like, who's going to do that? That's a lose-lose. It's going to protect the uterus, but then it's going to cause breast cancer. That makes zero sense at all.
Do you know where this argument is coming from? Because when they came up with the synthetic, so the clomiphene and tamoxifen, you're probably familiar with these drugs. Yeah. So they are synthetic estrogens. If you look at them, structurally they're similar to the infamous estrogen called diethylstilbestrol, DES, which was given to many women in the 60s during pregnancy too. So destroyed so many fetuses and lives and whatnot, and gave so many people cancer and killed them.
Yeah.
So the pharma industry said, okay, that thing is too strong. So let's see if we can use that structure and create something else. And they came up with these molecules that are all steel beans. So it's diethylstilbestrol. Guess what else is a steel bean? Resveratrol, which is being pushed to everybody under the sun. Also highly estrogenic. Yeah. The drug Vioxx that killed quite a few people in early 2000s, it got withdrawn. Also a steel bean molecule.
So the
Wow.
Stomy molecules are widely distributed in nature. There are many estrogenic molecules in nature. It's the plant's primary defense mechanism against pests like us. The plant says, "Do not dare eat me, or I will poison you," and that's how
Wow.
they poison you. But so they created clomiphene and raloxifene and a bunch of others and tamoxifen, and they said they tested them in vitro. And they said, damn, they're not as anti-estrogenic as we wanted. So let's see what happens. They actually found that they're estrogenic, which is expected because they're derivative of a very potent estrogen. So they gave them to some rats. They did an in vivo study, and they said, "Oh, okay. Well, it does have a very potent estrogenic effect in the uterus, in the ovaries, in the bones, and etc. But it's anti-estrogenic in the breasts. So we're going to market them as SERMs, selective estrogen receptor modulators. In some tissues they're estrogenic, in other tissues they're anti-estrogenic." Of course, I don't think that is true. I think we're going to find out later on. I don't know what the exact mechanism is, but I don't think they're working as anti-estrogens even in the breast, because I've talked to women that have been taking them for a long time for breast cancer and treatment and prevention. They're saying, "My breasts feel different and they don't feel feminine, and they feel like kind of like it's causing sagging breasts." And
Okay.
estrogen is known to do that in women because it suppresses the synthesis of pregnenolone and DHEA. And these are the two primary hormones that maintain the connective tissue and make your breasts perk up.
Wow.
So women have been taking these synthetic anti-SERMs for a long time and saying, "They're destroying my breasts." So anything that destroys your breasts, in my opinion, cannot really be viewed as breast protective. If
Right.
they have an anti-cancer effect, it's probably something else. It's not their,
Yeah.
supposed anti-estrogenic effect.
You know, the whole concept of the estriol being put, I'm hearing this a lot, that a lot of doctors are saying, if you apply estriol to like the labia, it's going to stay in that area. So you don't have to worry. And I'm thinking, wait, I mean, I learned this in basic chemistry and just basic biology, which is that anything you ingest through the skin, through the, you know, mouth through the respiratory tract has to go through at least second pass at the liver. It's going to go through at least the second phase of detox at the liver. It won't go through first pass if it's topical, but it's going to go through the liver. And depending on what the status of your phase two liver detox is going to determine what you do with your estrogen. And then, of course, phase
Exactly.
three, if you're recycling, you can completely turn that into something potent, right?
Yep. You want to shut the doctor down? So there is this thing called microchimerism. And basically, they found out that women that have died, and they did autopsy, they found samples of DNA from their husbands in their breasts. So how the hell does this thing get there? Well, you can imagine when the husband is ejaculating, that thing travels, and that's a much larger molecule than estriol. So if that thing can make its way through the entire body and get lodged into the brain, then estriol is a given that is going to eventually get metabolized and distributed. I think what they're trying to say, okay, look, the highest concentrations will be in the labia because that's where you apply it. And little by little, it gets excreted. It gets transferred by the bloodstream through the liver, and the second phase detox pathway takes care of it. The glucuronidation and whatever the sulfation, and then you pee it out, right? Yeah, but this process of like diffusing through the body, it's very obvious that it's far from harmless.
Yeah.
And there are many studies showing that you can actually get skin cancer from the local application of even a very weak estrogen.
Wow.
And if that's the case, then I don't see how applying it to the labia will be any different. Melanomas are known to form in places of the skin that don't see any sunlight. So melanoma, no matter how much they scare us with melanoma is not a sun-driven cancer. The basal cell carcinoma and the squamous cell carcinoma, which almost never kill because they don't spread, they're the ones that are tied to UV light damaging the DNA in the skin, but not melanoma. Most people get melanomas like at the bottom of their soles, between their legs, somewhere behind the ear on the scalp, like where there's a lot of hair. And melanoma is known to be estrogenically driven. I posted this study long time ago on the forum, and basically it was of course, from the 70s when people were still speaking the truth somewhat. And he basically said, "We don't know why would anybody claim that there is a cancer that does not get affected by hormones. That is the very point of hormones, to modulate tissue growth and differentiation."
Yeah.
So until serious evidence to the contrary is seen, and here is one cancer, by the way, that everybody says it's not endocrinologically driven. And guess what? When we gave too much estradiol to the rats, they developed melanoma de novo.
But we gave him an injection with melanoma cells, and then they gave him estradiol, the cancer grew even faster. When they gave him an anti-estrogen, the cancer disappeared. So really, you know, kind of like a very, very strong evidence that one of the most non-endocrinologically linked cancers is actually heavily driven by estrogen, which is not surprising at all. I mean, I don't think there's a cancer out there that is not driven by estrogen, but the claim that you're going to apply something locally and you're going to stay there and it's not going to cause any damage, it's the same claim that they give us for the mRNA vaccines. Oh, we're going to just inject you in the shoulder. And guess what? This mRNA, it doesn't diffuse. It just causes a local immune reaction there that activates the immune system and the entire body is protected. And then what do they find out later? Accumulates in the ovaries, accumulates in the spleen, accumulates in the gonads of the males, right? So basically, and nobody knows for how long it stays there. I think now they've done biopsies, like, what, 2 years after the vaccines came out? Mm-hmm. They're still finding mRNA in, like, various body tissues. And the mRNA, again, much bigger molecule than in the estriol. So if those things, massive things, can travel around, just like the sperm, the claim that estriol is somehow going to magically stay there and not cause any damage anywhere else, to me, is absurd. I don't know how a doctor would make that claim.
I know. It's crazy. Especially we know that, you know, any chemical that you touch, bleach or, you know, household chemicals, foundation on women's makeup, any of these things, they get into the bloodstream within, like, I think it's 26 seconds or something. Of course, it's going to do that with anything that you use. It's a pretty big lie. So I have a bunch of questions that I'm excited to ask about your new steroid test, your bioanalysis section of Ideal Labs, which I'm super thrilled about. And one of the first things I want to ask you that I haven't seen you address in all of your posts, because a lot of these questions you do address, and but a lot of people that I know would love to just hear it in the podcast. And the first one is, what made you even want to pursue a nail and hair steroid analysis or bioanalysis?
So there was a guy, a Russian guy that was that I interacted with on the forum years ago, I would say back in 2015. And he was very heavily into promoting the whole HTMA analysis, right? Mm-hmm. And a lot of people were doing these tests and sending the results to Ray and saying, hey, Ray, what do you think about this? And all of the, it's just mineral analysis, right? Mm-hmm. And Ray would either not respond or sometimes he'll come back and say, well, I would rather see steroids. So kind of gave me the idea. And also he said, I don't know that the hair, I think hair can be affected by things like hair conditioner, soap, whatever you're using to wash your hair. It may be changing the composition of the hair. So it may not be as reliable as some other species, some other pieces of tissue. And we know biopsy is the gold standard, right? But nobody's going to cut a piece of their finger and send me in the mail to analyze.
I probably would.
So they asked Ray, okay, so what other tissues could there be? And he said, I think for minerals specifically, I think nail would be better because the nail absorbs much more from the bloodstream and is basically much more indicative of tiny but significant variations over time, like of specific nutrients. And for estrogen, even a minor variation can have a big effect because the concentration of estradiol are so small. They're in the picogram per milliliter is what the blood test measure. And the same we measure in the hair in the picogram per milligram. Mm-hmm. So even very tiny changes matter a lot. But in blood, because the amount of estradiol is so small compared to all the other steroids that are there, you can have, because the amount is so small, you can have very large variations very quickly, right? So if you're testing for these for the steroids in the blood, specifically for estrogen, when I look at all the studies, a lot of people were saying, and I think Ray also said, is like the blood tests for estrogen in the blood are not reliable. You have to do a lot of them, let's say 10 tests over a period of 2 months, and then you got to average the results. And even then, the correlation between blood and tissue is not going to be one-to-one. And then multiple studies that I read later showed that basically the body accumulates steroids in concentrations up to 100 times higher, the tissues, than what is found in the blood. So the highest preference, and I already posted a study on the blog, but I can send it to you, the cells have the highest preference for pregnenolone and DHEA, and then progesterone, testosterone, and estradiol being the lowest. Actually, even cortisol before estradiol. But still, if you look at estradiol, the test that the study did show that you inside the cells you have concentrations up to 30 times higher than what's in the blood.
Wow.
So clearly, you cannot use the blood to kind of guesstimate, even with the repeated tests, what your estrogen levels in the tissues are, given that there's a difference of 30-fold, right? You don't want to know what's in the tissues. And then basically I started looking for studies if anybody has actually done steroid testing in hair and nails. And then I found all of these studies. However, if you go through these studies, you'll see that they have very different methodology. Some of them like bake the hair and then they pulverize it. But then the heat potentially destroys some of the steroids. Same thing is done for nails. Others freeze the sample with liquid nitrogen and then pulverize it. So the whole point is, when you're getting a piece of something that's basically looks like a chunk or like a hair, you can't just dump it into the solvent and extract things from it. It's not enough. You need to increase the surface area so you can extract as much as possible from of the steroids or whatever you're analyzing from the cells that are making up the sample. So really what this means is you need to grind this sample that you're getting into very tiny pieces. So I went through maybe about 100 studies. They all had different methodology. Then I decided, well, let's try it. Let's see what happens. So my group in Bulgaria, we bought a machine that analyzes. It's called LCMS, liquid chromatography.
Okay, so it is.
Yeah, mass spectrometry.
Okay. Yeah, it's an liquid LCMS chromatography analysis. Mass spectrum. Okay.
Yeah. So we did a couple of tests with hair and nails, and we try to analyze pregnant women and DHA because that study said that we should be seeing them in virtually all of the samples, and that turned out to be true. And then we started collecting samples from volunteers in Bulgaria and some people that I know, including relatives. And then we started doing also the mineral analysis and trying to correlate one and the other. And we started seeing some patterns. Basically, for the vast majority of people, we immediately saw a drastic decline in pregnenolone and DHEA in the cells with aging. But we did not see a decline in estrogen. And we did not see a decline in estradiol. And some of these women that sent us the samples were not only menopausal, they were in their 90s, okay? So in a 90-year-old woman, the levels of estradiol in her hair or nails was more or less at the level of a 30-year-old woman.
Oh,
so the whole
goodness.
Talk about, estrogen declining with age, I think is bunk. I don't think that is true. And then, miraculously or coincidentally, a group from China did a very large study with 250 women, very well-controlled study, and analyzed 27 different steroids or even more in the hair, including thyroid. And they found the exact same thing. They found out that T3 levels decline with age. T3 levels are inversely linked to obesity in their study. Progesterone levels decline with age. Progesterone levels are inversely correlated with obesity. And then estrogen levels do not decline with age. In fact, I think there was a small positive correlation with age. So the combination of our work and now that study from China coming out, I said, okay, we need to do this because I think one of the biggest myths and one of the most pernicious myths that medicine has ever invented and pushed is that menopause is a condition of basically estrogen deficiency. And the only thing they base this on is the blood tests, which they often perform once a year, okay? So it's really like it's like a double fraud. First of all, the blood tests are not reliable. Second of all, you do them only once a year, and these hormones can change in a matter of minutes. So they're testing for estradiol, they're testing for progesterone. Both are below the limit of detection in most menopausal women. And medicine says, see, condition of estrogen deficiency. Now, even with the blood tests, it is also a condition of progesterone deficiency, but you never hear any doctor talk about this. Mm. It's all about menopause being estrogen deficient. So let's pump these women full of estrogen and somehow restore vitality. At the very least, if they trusted the blood tests, they should have been given both.
Yeah.
But I don't know of any doctor that has considered doing both. And only lately, they're starting doing kind of both, but they're giving the synthetic progestin. They're not giving the bioidentical.
I mean, what a farce. I mean, I think a lot of doctors just don't think of progesterone as being, they think of it as a pregnancy hormone for young women. They don't think, and I don't understand that. I mean, who knows why they do that?
Well, I mean, I think they've noticed that a young pregnant woman produces, 600 to 800 milligrams of progesterone daily in the last trimester of pregnancy. Men never do that unless they have a tumor. You can't have an endocrine-producing tumor, endocrine tumor that produces steroids, and very rarely can produce progesterone. But I don't know of a single case reported that produces only progesterone. It usually produces something else, and then the progesterone is basically a byproduct of it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think because the progesterone has been mostly associated in blood tests with, you know, being coming at these very high values in young, healthy, or pregnant women. That's how it acquired the you know, the reputation of being a pregnancy hormone. But it's the same thing applies to estrogen. They're claiming it's a female hormone, right? Responsible for ovulation, all these great things. I then just posted a study on my blog yesterday saying that it's the low androgens, the decline of androgens with age, but not low estrogens, that are basically predictive of a woman developing cardiovascular disease. You go to any doctor, you walk out of your room right now, you go to a local hospital and say, what is the primary role of estrogen in the cardiovascular disease? They'll say it's the best protector you can get. It's basically the reason women get higher risk of heart attacks and strokes after menopause is because their estrogen levels decline. That study said absolutely not. And in fact, the author said, I don't know who came up with this dumb idea that estradiol is a female hormone and testosterone is a male hormone. Both sexes produce them, and they're important to the health of both sexes. But in our study, contrary to the expectations for both steroids, we did not find estrogen to be protective, and we did not find testosterone to be harmful. In fact, we found testosterone to be protective in women. And that's something that's probably paradoxical to most women that are hearing, and even most of the doctors are saying, hold on a second, does that mean I should be giving you testosterone? Read the study. The authors of the study, all of them MDs, are saying, yes, if there is a deficiency in androgens, you should consider giving testosterone, or at the very least DHEA, because in women, DHEA metabolizes predominantly into androgens, into testosterone. So really, two myths kind of busted with one study. One, testosterone is bad for women, and specifically bad for the cardiovascular system. Two, estrogen is good for women, right? And also, third myth is estrogen declines with age, and the decline of estrogen with age is what's really causing all of these cardiovascular problems in women. All three myths in one study, gone.
Wow. Well, wait, what about osteoporosis?
Well, that's really what the doctor's saying. They're saying, okay, so estrogen is anabolic for the bone. But if you look at the tests that are being done, most of the tests are done in vitro. And in vitro, you will see that estrogen stimulates the proliferation of both the osteoclasts and the osteoblasts, right? Mm-hmm. But these studies are very short term. So if you give estrogen long enough, what estrogen also does very reliably, and in fact, it's the primary driver of prolactin increase in the body. If you want to really test your levels of estrogen in tissues, check your prolactin levels, because prolactin is the surrogate for how much estrogen is in the entire body, because it's the estrogen acting on the pituitary that makes it release prolactin. And it's a very good reason for that, basically. Like after you've given birth and your progesterone levels have declined, then estrogen kind of runs unopposed for a while because you need to be nursing, right? You need to be breastfeeding. And
estrogen runs unopposed by progesterone. That means that it's no longer modulating the estrogen. Yes. It's letting it go a little bonkers so that you can nurse. That is so important. Okay, carry on.
And we have this ratio in the report, which is the progesterone to estrogen ratio. Doctors know about it, by the way, but not many will tell you about it. If you ask it, they may tell you about it. It's supposed to be no less than 100 to 1 in favor of progesterone. So when you do the blood tests, if your progesterone to estradiol is less than 100, you're in a state of estrogen dominance, even if your estrogen levels are below the norm that is of the normal range. You're still estrogen dominant. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But you need to be 500 or above in order to be actually estrogen to be under, you know, the control of progesterone. And then since progesterone rises tremendously during pregnancy, much more than estrogen does, I think that ratio rises to maybe 10 or even 11 to 1. I'm sorry, 1,000 to 1 to 1,100 to 1. And after the woman gives birth, the progesterone levels drastically decline. And then the ratio probably drops to around 100 and stays there for a while so the prolactin can rise and ensure that there's enough. And what's the role of the prolactin? To mobilize calcium and also prolactin, right? It basically stimulates the production of milk by the mammary gland. But the synthesis of the milk depends on calcium. And this calcium, since many women are deficient in calcium in their diet, this calcium can come from only one place, and that is their bones. So whenever a doctor tells you that estrogen is anabolic for the bone, ask them, how can estrogen be anabolic for the bone if it raises prolactin? And prolactin is perhaps the most catabolic hormone for the bone ever known.
Wow.
Together with cortisol, but prolactin specifically shreds. Cortisol is kind of indiscriminate, destroys everything that can be converted to energy. Well, prolactin specifically targets the bone because it needs the calcium to come out of the bone.
Wow. Okay. So the estrogen is can be anabolic and catabolic. It can do
The
both.
estrogen, well, not really, because if you look at the longer term studies when actually they gave estrogen in vivo to the animals, the proliferation of the osteoclasts, which are the bone destroying cells, predominates over the osteoblasts. Initially, it's reversed in the first 1 or 2 weeks, but after, and that's probably why kind of matches the experience that I mentioned initially. Like doctors saying, "Look, we give a menopausal woman even a little bit of estrogen, and all her symptoms immediately disappear." Yeah, for a week. And then they come
Yeah.
back with a vengeance, and you start lying and coming up with like ridiculous explanations why it's not the estrogen, because it couldn't have helped you from the beginning, and now it's hurting you somehow. It doesn't work like that. It does work like that.
Okay.
And basically, estrogen is an acute phase hormone. You want it to arise in situations where you need something to be repaired. You need cellular proliferation, right? That's really, it's a de-differentiating, very potent cellular proliferation hormone. I want to call it a growth hormone, because that has a different connotation for most people, but it does stimulate the synthesis of new
Biogenic.
tissue. Yeah, exactly.
So, okay, my
And if
little
it's not
brain.
controlled by a differentiating hormone, that's how you get the cancer. All that it takes for cancer to form is the unmitigated activity of a growth hormone or a proliferating hormone such as estrogen. Another one is prolactin. Another one is growth hormone. Another one, I think, is leptin. So if you do anything to allow these hormones to run on a pulse for a while, then eventually you get cancer, which is, that's all there is. It's just an uncontrolled proliferation of cells that are not being incorporated in an organ. They just kind of, they don't talk to each other, and they don't participate in the organism. They just drain you of energy, and they do their own thing.
So my little basic brain sees it in a way that we really do need the estrogen because it is
Oh, yeah.
proliferative, it is mitogenic, it does help to grow bone if it is opposed by estrogen and modulated or regulated, otherwise it can just wreak havoc. Or is that completely not right in regards to growing bone? Like, how could they be so wrong about the osteoporosis component? I mean, literally, you ask any person, walk, you stop someone on the street and you say, what is estrogen good for in aging women? And they would say, keeps you from getting osteoporosis. So that had to come from somewhere. I feel like.
I think the in vitro studies initially that show that estrogen does stimulate the production of the osteoclasts and osteoblasts, and the osteoblast proliferation was a little bit more than the osteoclast. So they say, oh, estrogen stimulates the growth of new
The
bone,
growth of bone.
but that's time dependent and eventually reverses. And especially once you start increasing prolactin in the organism, then
Okay.
and all hell breaks loose. Estrogen also stimulates, irritates the adrenals and stimulates the synthesis of cortisol. So in a living body, which you cannot really see in those cells, because those cells that they tested them with, the bone cells, they're not capable of producing cortisol themselves. So you're really seeing the isolated effects of estrogen on a very specific set of cells that can only respond. They only have a very specific machinery, not indicative of what the entire body can do. So when you give them estrogen for a week, they proliferate more in favor of the anabolic response. However, even if in those isolated cells, if you keep giving estrogen without anything else, after 2 weeks, this response reverses, and you have now more osteoclasts, which are bone dissolving cells, right?
Osteoclast.
However, yeah, in the living organism, whenever you inject estrogen, you're not dealing with an isolated set of cells. You're dealing with the systemic response. And the systemic response of estrogen includes invariably the release of prolactin and the release of cortisol, both of which are ridiculously catabolic for the bone, especially prolactin. And this is being kind of confirmed in many studies that when they give women only estrogen, especially women on the estrogen-only birth control pill, they actually are known to have early menopause, osteopenia, and osteoporosis long before they get to the age group that these things are usually seen.
Wow.
Conversely, when the women are given anabolic steroids, most of which are anti-estrogenic, they actually get, improvement in bone. In bone health. And there is the latest iteration of the anti-estrogenic drugs known as aromatase inhibitors, such as exemestane. Exemestane limits your production of estrogen and limits it really, really strongly. It's a suicide inhibitor, so-called. But exemestane is anabolic for the bone. So how can an anti-estrogenic substance cause such a great response in bone growth and actually improve bone strength and bone thickness if estrogen is the primary factor in bone health. This thing really decimates estrogen. So, I mean, just another myth that I think it's going to take a while to dispel. But now with the estrogen being pushed by the pharma companies again as like a therapy for so many women,
yeah,
I'm not very optimistic.
There's a new documentary coming out. I was trying to look for it on PBS that is about endometriosis, but it's an executive producer is Hillary Clinton.
No, by the way, Hillary Clinton, despite what she may tell you on TV, she has a very different health regimen. I don't know if you've seen it.
No.
There's some bits and pieces leaked to the media. She, every once in a while in interviews, she says, well, she's taking thyroid, she's taking aspirin, she's taking vitamin E, she's taking gelatin. So all of these things are basically vegetarian. Yes.
So, well, maybe there's hope for that documentary, but I'm sure I predict the overall message is going to be estrogen protects the uterus is what I think.
There's no hope for that documentary. The message, what she's doing, she's saying, do as I say, not as I do. I don't think she's ever told people, hey, it's a good idea to take thyroid, or it's a good idea to take vitamin E. And she very rarely discusses her personal regimen. So the message that she puts out there, which is pure propaganda, like most politicians, I don't want to pick on Hillary alone, plenty of politicians are like that, basically is probably whatever her pharma buddies have sponsored her
to say. Exactly, her lobbyists. So what do you think about this new study that came out about endometriosis being driven by a bacterial infection? Did you see that?
It's possible. It's possible because just like rheumatoid arthritis, when they look at the joints, the swollen joints of people, and they took some biopsy samples, they found antibodies to several bacteria, and even they found components of some of the gram-negative bacteria, which is usually in your colon, right?
Mm.
Basically, this kind of says that endotoxin is involved. So basically, you produce a lot of endotoxin, you destroy the gut barrier, through many different means. Alcohol can do it very well. Chronic inflammation can do it very well. People with Crohn's disease, in general, inflammatory bowel disease, a very, very compromised intestinal barrier. And they, by the way, they have a higher rate of rheumatoid arthritis, of endometriosis, and all these things. So if you, this bacteria has to have come there from somewhere, right? Mm. And usually the inside of the body is sterile. It's the gastrointestinal tract that really has most of our bacteria. So it's really a matter of time, a matter of looking at what this bacteria that was found in the endometriosis samples is, and whether it's represented in the gut. My bet is it is.
Yeah.
Because the same thing has been shown for lupus. The same thing has been shown for rheumatoid arthritis. So really, if you have translocating bacteria, yes, the body will form some kind of an immune response. There will be chronic inflammation. And this bacteria cannot get destroyed. Then eventually, some kind of a fibroid scar tissue will form there because the body tries to insulate it, encapsulate it, and keep it sort of intact.
It makes so much sense, yeah.
But I think it deflects. They're trying to do this because they try to do the same thing with cancer and with Alzheimer's disease. They've been running this is kind of like a bit of a psyop. They've been running this since the 60s, saying, hey, cancer is caused by a virus. Let's keep looking for the virus. You know why? Because they love the vaccines. And they love antivirus.
For endometriosis is coming.
Exactly. Yes.
Oh, yeah,
and
a vaccine
for cancer is coming. And for HIV and whatever. Yeah. I'm not for HIV because now I think they finally now realized, and they couldn't convince the public, that HIV is the bane of everyone's existence because simply people don't die of AIDS as everybody said they would. Mm-hmm. And then there was the study from California, which I don't know if you've seen. They followed 92,000 heterosexual couples for over 10 years. And one of the partners was HIV positive. Over 10 years, 92 people, having fun time like rabbits. Only two confirmed cases.
Oh my God.
Of only two. 100,000 people over 10 years copulating, only two transmissions of HIV. So clearly something is definitely very, very wrong about this whole theory of HIV and AIDS and whatnot. And I think they've kind of like pushed this to the side.
Yeah.
When RFK Jr. came up with this new book on Fauci,
the real Anthony
I think he
Fauci.
Spent the first half of the book destroying the AIDS narrative. If you remember, the media crickets, they said nothing about the first half of the book. They only focused on the second half where he, I think, basically said that, you know, Fauci's a crook. He's been, you know, doing the gain of function with his new virus and whatnot. But really, the book is about this guy's been doing the exact same thing in the 80s, since the 80s, and killed really a lot of people with his toxic drugs and proposed vaccines and whatnot. And it's the exact same thing. Some mystery virus really comes out of nowhere and it causes AIDS. By the way, AIDS used to be known as gay cancer or great gay-related immune disorder. They only renamed it later, you know, not to stigmatize the gays. But the final stages of AIDS are indistinguishable from cancer. From they even have this thing called Kaposi sarcoma, which is a very like AIDS-specific kind of cancer. And it's basically these people expire in a condition of wasting, cachectic condition, identical to the one from cancer. So they thought that if they could come up with a vaccine for HIV, then they could come up with a vaccine for cancer. And they've been pushing this idea from the 60s that most of the current diseases in the body are caused by some kind of an infection, an unrecognized infection, because an infection, whether bacterial or viral, usually implies a vaccine can be developed. And that's their preferred method.
Interesting.
If it's something that's metabolic, they don't want to hear that.
Right.
You know, because with a vaccine, you can get a booster, you know, you can get it multiple times.
And now that we know, now that they know, they can really scare people really badly into, and most people will do it. So yeah, that makes perfect sense. And just a side note, I don't want to go bonkers on this, but in that Real Anthony Fauci book at the beginning, he talks about how the AIDS virus really went wild because of the poppers that they were doing.
Yeah. Nitric oxide generating drugs. And that's one of the most powerful immune suppressants you can ingest. Another study I'm about to post in the blog shows that nitric oxide drives autism. So many different things can drive autism, but it's just nitric oxide, which many doctors are recommending, are saying you take it for heart protection, right? You take it for improving your performance in the gym, right? For vascularity.
Everybody's talking about nitric oxide right now. Yeah.
This study said if you give a nitric oxide precursor, then you can reproduce all of the symptoms of autism. If you give a molecule that inhibits the synthesis of nitric oxide, niacinamide, methylene blue, whatever, they use some different drug, but I mentioned the ones that are over the counter, aspirin even, then you can reverse and for good. You can reverse, and I don't want to use the old cure, but anything, permanent remission. You can induce a permanent remission of autism by inhibiting the synthesis of nitric oxide.
That is shocking. Okay, let's go back to your test. So I want to know, okay, we already covered it's liquid chromatography, mass spectrometry. Can it be, okay, no, you answered that. Is this testing intended to be diagnostic, or is it also possible to monitor treatment? Like, how quickly does it show up in your nails and hair?
So for the nails, it's kind of like we currently prefer the hair for very practical reasons. So when you look at your nail from the base of the nail to the top of the nail, if you make a mark here with a permanent marker, it's going to take about 3 months to go to the top.
Oh wow!
And then and the same on the toes. And then it's going to take another month probably to basically grow to the point where you can cut it. So when you send us a nail clipping, it shows a period of about 1 month, 3 to 4 months in the past. That's a very specific time period, and it cannot really be modulated. I mean, I'm not going to ask you to pull your entire nail and send it to me so I can analyze the bottom of it, right, and tell you what happened in the last week. Hair can naturally do that. Every half an inch of hair measured from the scalp out represents about a month in the past. And several studies that came out recently show that basically things start accumulating in the hair within 24 hours of being present in the blood.
Wow.
So we can do like a really short-term analysis of like the last week, if you're careful enough to send me such short clipping of hair that is basically, 1 week is 1/4 of a month. So 1/4 of a half inch. So if you send me 1/8 of an inch long hair samples cut from the scalp, we'll be able to tell you your hormonal profile over the last week.
Wow.
And conversely, the other good thing is that if you want a really much longer period, if you send me a 6-inch piece of hair long enough, and then we ground it all up, you extract the steroids, we're going to tell you the average levels of these steroids over the last year.
Cool.
And that's done with a single test, right? Imagine how many tests you had to do with blood in order to cover this entire period. Most doctors will not do it because there's a regulation in many states that says that you shouldn't be doing a vein puncture more often than once every 2 weeks, because you're causing stress to the system and it can change the biomarkers. And it can cause rise of lactic dehydrogenase, of cortisol, because it's an anti-inflammatory hormone. Whenever you do a vein puncture, there's a supposedly localized reaction, just like this estrogen on the labia, which turns out to be not local at all. Basically, the
Right.
body doesn't like it, and you're going to get a systemic kind of like a stress response, and you're going to get basically highly elevated levels of, not highly, but elevated levels, abnormally elevated levels of cortisol and potentially estrogen, which are not indicative of your normal state. So only by taking a very long period of time, which kind of averages things out, you can kind of gauge your hormonal profile on a daily basis. That's the average you,
Wow.
without the extremes. With the blood test, you really are measuring that specific moment and your specific reaction to those specific circumstances. If you have a doctor that you really like, and that doctor kind of puts you at ease, and you're not afraid, and basically like you enjoy being in the presence of this doctor, then then when the doctor takes a blood sample and analyzes for steroids, you're probably going to show lower than average cortisol, estrogen, and prolactin. Now, if you go to a very psychopathic doctor that kind of berates you, argues with you, really like stiffens up the situation, chances are that the stress hormones will be higher than what your baseline is. And we don't want
Wow.
that. We don't want either one of these. We want your
Yeah.
average, which is your how you really perform on a daily basis. And that can be done by looking at, I would say, at least a week. But since a week would be 1 inch, 1/8 of an inch, it's hard to measure. I would say a month. The last month is kind of like a, it's kind of, is, I think it's useful for most people because they kind of remember what happened over the last month, right? Yeah, including things that they ate. I mean, not every day, but like, hey, yeah, 3 weeks ago I had a food poisoning, or like, oh,
Yeah.
4 weeks ago I got really plastered at a wedding, that kind of thing. So
Okay.
they can remember their life events and potentially explain what the steroid profile shows.
Interesting. Dr. Platt wrote Adrenaline Dominance, and he mentions, I think he mentions in the book, or it might have been in my podcast, that even going to get saliva cortisol results is not necessarily accurate, because even though they say that it is the most accurate, because
No.
if you actually have adrenal insufficiency or you have adrenaline dominance, your salivary glands are not going to be producing accurately what you hope for, you know? So is that true too?
It's true in many other areas in the body can produce cortisol. Adipose tissue can produce it. They have the enzyme 11 beta HSD1 and 2.
Mm.
So even without adrenal glands, you can potentially have very high cortisol if you measure it in a specific area of the body. Salivary cortisol represents mostly what happens in the salivary glands, and I
Oh.
would say like the front side of the head. They don't represent what's in the brain, most certainly, and they don't represent like necessarily what's happening in the rest of the body. It's a localized response. So if you have a local inflammatory reaction, if we assume it's local, like gingivitis. People with gingivitis have been shown to have, on average, higher saliva cortisol levels than the rest of the population. But
Oh.
their blood cortisol levels are normal. They're basically
Interesting.
like the rest of the population. So it's a localized thing. Maybe if you do it over time, you can kind of build a curve and see how it correlates with the blood tests. I don't know of any studies that have done it so many times simply because then you would need the corresponding test in blood every single time you do a saliva. And like I said, most doctors are kind of like under ethical orders not to do this more often than every 2 weeks. And it's just annoying, to run a study like that for so long. If you want a study that produces good results, it should last on average no longer than 2 weeks. If you have to track people for a year and keep, calling them and say, come back, I need to take another blood sample or a saliva sample, chances are they're gonna basically drop off the study, and
Yeah.
then you're gonna have a very different sample at the end compared to what you had from the beginning.
Interesting.
Yeah, so saliva cortisol not reliable, especially as a single test.
Okay. And then can it, let's talk about what it shows exactly. So can it show prolactin, the
Not
male?
the
So, yeah.
peptides yet, prolactin and insulin, no. But we are currently testing all of the. So we're testing pregnenolone, progesterone, the 17-hydroxylated metabolites, because they can also show things such as congenital adrenal hyperplasia, which we're finding some people have. Then we're also testing, so from the androgens, we're testing DHEA, DHEA sulfate, testosterone, dihydrotestosterone, androstenedione, androsterone, the 11-keto testosterone, and 11-keto dihydrotestosterone. So pretty much all of the androgens that kind of matter to a male or female, we're testing. Then from the glucocorticoids, we're testing cortisol, cortisone, aldosterone, 21. Hydroxy, no, 20-dehydrocorticosterone, corticosterone. So there's about six or seven of the glucocorticoids that we're testing.
Okay.
And then from the estrogens, we're testing estrone, estradiol, and estriol, because those are the three main ones. And now we're thinking of also potentially adding, there's one called estratetrol, so four hydroxyl groups, but that one is even weaker than estriol, but I think it still matters because it does show up in some conditions.
Okay.
And then there's some estrogenic metabolites, but the estrone, estradiol and estriol, these three together is usually everything a doctor needs to kind of like look at that. And when you add these with different coefficients and then you take progesterone, then you can get the ratio of progesterone to total estrogens. And that kind of gives you a very good idea of your estrogen dominance as a woman. For
Wow.
males, it's usually the total androgens versus the as a ratio of total towards the total estrogens that really matters. And I have some studies that are there on the page for ordering and on the blog showing that obesity, gynecomastia, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, all of these things are characterized in males by a low suboptimal ratio of total androgens to estrogens. The optimal ratio should be 50 or above in favor of androgens for males. And the optimal ratio of progesterone to total estrogens should be, doctors are saying at least 100. We're finding out that that's the bare minimum. You need it to be at least 200 or more in order to kind of be in a decent health.
Oh, wow. And then, so no peptide hormones, no melatonin.
Melatonin, no melatonin. Yes, we'll be able to test melatonin. Melatonin, yeah, melatonin, serotonin, melatonin. Actually, the group just informed me in Bulgaria because that's where the lab is that the melatonin is showing up on all of the hair samples that I've tested so far.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
Cool.
so really, we can currently test a lot of things, a lot of neurotransmitters. The problem is we don't have ranges for them. So if we
Okay.
test your melatonin, I don't know if, because we have to collect a large group of people to form the normal range.
Okay.
I can give you a value, but I don't know if it's lower than the if it's like below optimal or above optimal, right?
That was the
So
next
we're in a,
question was how large is the
yeah.
database for determining the normal ranges?
Oh, for the steroids, it's like it's 500 to 600 people at this point.
Okay.
For the minerals, even higher because for the minerals, there's already like publications from other groups, done in the past. For the neurotransmitters, we're currently collecting them, and I think we have about 50 people right now. We personally feel comfortable when we have at least 100 to like to report on a range.
Okay,
So
wow.
hopefully by the end of the summer, we're gonna have a range. But as far as testing is concerned, we can test serotonin, dopamine, the metabolites of serotonin and dopamine, such as 5-hydroxyindole acid, homovanillic acid, vanilla acetic acid, histamine, and then also the epinephrine and norepinephrine and the precursors tyrosine and phenylalanine.
Okay.
So it should be a really cool profile as far as these like neurotransmitters, which are also indicative of adrenal function as well.
And so
Like
then
for example,
thyroid,
yeah.
we'd be able to tell something about thyroid ranges as well.
Oh, we already have them.
Okay. Did
Yeah,
you say?
thyroid is currently testable. We can test T3, T4, and reverse T3 in both hair and nails, but we're finding that in nails, not all the samples produce a result. While in hair, just like the Chinese people did, I mentioned the large study they did, it shows up in 100% of the samples. So
Wow.
if you want to do thyroid tests, currently we only offer it in hair simply because we can do it in both. But you don't want to send us a sample, and I can tell you out of the two hormone, out of the three thyroids, only one showed up. People kind of feel like, disappointed. Like, well, did you test for the other two?
Yeah,
Why am
yeah.
I paying for three hormones, but I'm getting the result of only one?
Got
So if you want all three
it.
to show up, it's, send me a hair sample. And the ranges for those are established. They're pretty solid. The Chinese people have a very well-established range for women. We did one for men as well. So now we have for both.
Great.
And it's pretty reliable, to be honest with you. Like every single person that came to us, and a lot of people will send us a sample, but they don't tell us what's wrong with them, which is good, right? We're testing in the blind. And then when the results come back, then we send them back. And so far, everybody that has emailed us back has said, yeah, the doctor suspected I had like hypothyroidism, but my TSH is in range. So he couldn't prescribe anything. However, now your test shows very low T3. So the doctor he has to take this into account.
Yeah, wow, that's really good. What about topical creams and supplementation of hormones like pregnenolone and progesterone? Is that showing up or is that, do we know?
Ridiculously well. Yes.
Really?
Yeah. And I'll send you a thread on the forum. There is a woman that lives in Virginia and she sent us like some samples to analyze. And basically, usually, let's say the range for pregnenolone is between 20 and 100 picograms per milligram of tissue, because we're measuring tissue. And then her pregnenolone comes back at like 5,000. So clearly something is going on. Either something's wrong with the adrenal glands, right? Or she's supplementing. But like I said, the good thing is they never tell us what they're actually taking, so we're testing in the blind. So she posted the results on the forum and said, "Yep, I'm supplementing pregnenolone. I never expected that 10 milligrams a day will cause such a large increase, will spike the levels to the point of being several times, outside of the range," which shows you, by the way, you don't need as much pregnenolone. So if you're taking just a few milligrams a day, it's probably enough to like to produce a benefit.
And
If
that's
that's kind of
oral for
corroborated,
her.
yeah, oral. And there's a study with humans show that, I know it's hard to believe, 1 milligram of pregnenolone taken before bed was enough to drastically improve the quality and duration of sleep. And you
Wow.
wouldn't think that such a minuscule dose would have any effect, but it did. And it's showing up on the tests. The tests are very, very sensitive. So if you're supplementing with something, we'll know.
Wow, good, good. And then what about, so a lot of women dye their hair. I do not, as you can see. And then a lot of women get, their nails done. And so what can they do? Can they use pubic hair or how does that work?
They can use any hair they want. We found out, actually, believe it or not, since you mentioned pubic hair, the team that is over there, both males and females, they tested all kinds of hair from their bodies. And we did find kind of like somewhat of a different results. Pubic hair is an outlier. It has very high amounts of all the steroids that we're testing. And it does not really fall into the ranges that are reported because almost all of the ranges that we took were based on scalp hair. That's what most
Okay.
people said. Pubic hair, probably because of the proximity to the gonads, there's much higher levels of androgens for males and progesterone and estrogens and testosterone for females. So you
Wow.
can send pubic hair, but the ranges will be a little bit skewed. We'll probably have a note in the report which says, the normal range for pubic hair, if you take the normal range, probably needs to be multiplied by at least two, like both the lower and the higher value. So instead of running, let's say, from 20 to 40, it'll run from 40 to 80. So if we're analyzing pubic hair. So you
Okay.
can send any hair you want, but body hair and scalp and beard even look pretty reliable and fall within the range for scalp. Pubic hair was an outlier and had much higher levels of every hormone that we tested, except thyroid. The thyroid over there showed up at a lower levels than in the rest of the body.
Oh, interesting. Okay. And then let's see. Do hormone levels in these tissues have different normals? Oh, based on ethnicity and race. These are some of the questions that were sent to me. Variations based on age. That seems obvious, that one.
Variation based on age, yes, we do. We found out that when we actually average all of the results out across all age groups, it's very hard to actually get an outlier unless the person is really sick. But we can report them based on age if that's what the person wants.
Yeah.
It's just that the ones for pregnenolone and DHEA, we kind of want to keep the original range because we want to show the decline. Because if you go to the doctor and test DHEA or pregnenolone, right, depending on your age, they're going to come back with you with a specific range. And they'll say, "Oh, your DHEA is perfectly within range for a 60-year-old person. We don't want it to be in the range of a 60-year-old person. We want it to be in the range of a 30-year-old person." And that can only be seen if we compare it against that range for a 30-year-old person, or conversely, to take the range for the entire age group, because since the older people will be lower, they're not going to change the range much, right? And then basically see like where your specific value holds. And we also have the ratios, which are very important. So even if, let's say, your both cortisol and DHEA may fall within the normal range, but if the ratio of cortisol to DHEA is higher than, let's say, 0.5, then you're under chronic stress. And it does not matter where in the range of the individual steroids you fall. Chronic stress, period. Multiple studies have shown that the cortisol to DHEA ratio is the most reliable, currently available predictor for all-cause mortality and morbidity for both. So if you test nothing else but cortisol and DHEA, they will be the most systemic predictor of how long you would live and what's your risk of developing a disease over the next 3 to 5 years.
Ouch. Because we know that is like, I mean, I look at Dutch's every day and that ratio is crazy. And it was for me for years. I have to, that's why I really want to do this because I want to see what's changed.
You can
Okay.
modulate it. It's not a set in stone. It's not your destiny, right? It's
Right.
only a destiny if you do nothing about it.
Right. And then, as far as like, low levels of hormones doesn't necessarily mean a bad thing. It just, it has to be in balance, right? This is the issue here. So people are always like, Kat, why do you want people to take progesterone and pregnenolone and testosterone? You know, when we're aging, we're not supposed to have these hormones. And it's like, no, you are supposed to have them. They're just not, they don't necessarily have to be in abundance, but they have to be in balance.
In balance, yes. And it's the balance that really gets thrown off with age, and almost no doctor talks about it. It's like I'm not a, like if the doctor showed you that on your blood test, your cortisol levels, they kind of peak at an age of about 20, and they kind of stay stable throughout your entire life. Cortisol almost never declines unless you're dying or you get like Addison disease. But DHEA after the age of 30 precipitously declines, which means the ratio of cortisol to DHEA, despite cortisol staying stable, it's going to balloon. No doctor talks about this, right?
Right.
But that's really what matters, and that's what determines your risk of disease and many different things. So it's like, so they're focusing on the fact that your DHEA is in range for your age group, and cortisol is in range for your age group. So nothing's wrong. You're perfectly fine. You're not fine. Your cortisol to DHEA ratio grows with age, and after it passes the 0.5, all hell starts to break loose. Every single study that has looked at that ratio has showed it. And that's unisex. And it applies to children. It applies to old people. It applies to everybody. Then you can do sex specific. I think for the women, the progesterone to total estrogens and also the cortisol to DHEA is very good. For males, total androgens to total estrogens and cortisol to testosterone is also a very good ratio. Very reliable predictor of male fertility and obesity is that the cortisol to testosterone ratio should not be over 10. The study that I looked at, I think it had like 100 different males. Not a single male with a cortisol to testosterone ratio over 10 was basically normal weight. They're all obese. And the higher the ratio, like the more severe the obesity was.
Wow. So yeah, cortisone exactly in relation to cortisol. So I have my Constantine questions. He says hello. Yeah. So basically he said, ask him what is cortisone exactly in relation to cortisol was his
the precursor.
Question.
So cortisone is the oxidized version and cortisol is the reduced one. And this enzyme that converts one into the other, it's bidirectional, by the way, and it depends on your redox status. In other words, how oxidized versus how reduced you are. And we know that if your metabolism is working properly, you should be tilted in favor of oxidation, which means that the cortisol to cortisone ratio should be lower in a healthier person than it is in a sicker person. And that's exactly what we're seeing. The cortisol to cortisone ratio also has an optimal interval, and we're finding out that the cortisol to cortisone ratio should not be higher than 0.2. If it's higher than 0.2, then you basically have more cortisol than cortisone. Well, not more, but like proportionally more. Mm-hmm. And then basically, once you reach the 0.5 or above, just like the cortisol to DHEA ratio, we're starting seeing things like obesity, diabetes, mental disorders, especially depression. Cortisol is now has been almost undeniably implicated in depression. The only people deny it is psychiatrists. But you talk to anybody in basic research, they know that cortisol causes depression. Conversely, anti-cortisol drugs are used to treat depression. So the cortisol to cortisone ratio is a very good indicator of your redox status. And it's similar to the NAD to the NADH ratio, which we've discussed before. Mm-hmm. It's also similar to the pyruvate to the lactate ratio. One is oxidized, the other one reduced, right? So really, that's what it is. You're taking something that's reduced, and it's something that's oxidized, and you're looking at the ratio. And you want it to be in favor of the oxidized, which means you're consuming oxygen at the appropriate rates and all of the reducing agents in your body, because food is an electron donor. Food is a reductant. It's donate electrons. Means food is properly processed, and all these electrons are flowing where they are supposed to be flowing, ultimately to oxygen. If you're more into the reduced state, which means whatever is happening inside of your body, this flow of electrons is blocked somewhere, and they accumulate, and cortisol is one of the biomarkers of accumulation of electrons. Hmm. Lactic acid is another one. Reduced glutathione, the GSH, is another one. There's also, of course, oxidized glutathione called GSSG. The GSSG to the GSA ratio is also a very good biomarker. You can do all these in blood. But again, the ratio in blood will be only indicative for like the next couple hours or sometimes even seconds, because these things change so fast.
Yeah.
But when you do it in here, then you kind of know, okay, was I in a good metabolic state over the last month or not on average? And if the answer is no, because it means predominantly no over this period, then means probably need to take steps. It's okay to be in a bad metabolic state the day before because basically you had a rough night. But if this is multiplied by an entire month, then it's something that you probably need to you need to take care of. Doctors actually kind of have a similar principle. When you go there and you have an abnormal blood test, unless the tests are really absurd, basically where they're suspecting something very dangerous, they're going to send you home and say, come back in 2 weeks. They're not going to take action immediately. And that's what we're avoiding really with this test. Like, you don't have to go back. And in fact, when you go back, there's no guarantee that that test will not get going to be skewed either. Two tests don't make a, what is it? The plural of analog, the plural of anecdote is data. So when you're doing individual blood tests, this adds anecdotal. But when you're doing a hair test, that's data because it covers a much longer period of time and the outliers are smoothened out, right? And also, it's not stressful. You don't have to get your vein punctured. You don't have to go to a doctor, sit in line, meet other sick people, right? That's all of this is stressful. This is avoided. Just clip here and you send it and forget about it.
And what was the PDE ratio on your test? The progesterone
What
to
I mean, PDE?
estrogen, the
Oh.
progesterone to estrogen,
So it
like.
should be, I mean, we're reporting that should be above 100 for like really minimal, like at a minimum should be above 100. And the ratio reported in the literature is between 100 and 500. So, which tells me that they don't want the ratio to be higher than 500, but we know it becomes higher than 500 during pregnancy. And nothing bad is happening to these pregnant women when they have this massively high ratio of progesterone to estrogens. So I would like to see it. I mean, the women that have been sending us these results and then later reporting on their health status, no woman in self-reported good health get a progesterone to total estrogen ratio lower than 200. The ones that had between 100 and 200, they all had problems. The ones below 100 were usually with cancer.
And the final question for you, and this is a big one because I've had many doctors over the years on my podcast and one recently who I absolutely adore. And they all say to me this, okay, so we find out we have estrogen in the tissues, not in circulation, perimenopause, menopausal woman, no estrogen, having signs of all these low estrogen. What do we do? Just stare at her and say, sorry, you have loads of estrogen. We can't help you. Or do we give her the relief she needs?
You give her the relief in the form of DHEA. Two very large studies found that vaginal application of just 6.5 milligrams of DHEA topically on the labia resolved all of the annoying symptoms of menopause, the hot flashes, the irritation, the lack of libido, basically the fatigue. All of these things were basically relieved like magic. And then, in addition, I think it was the same dosage. Was given to premenopausal women who were trying to get pregnant but had trouble to getting pregnant, and I think that they had already given up to conceive naturally, so they were preparing in vitro. So they had several failed in vitro attempts. So they gave them the exact same dosage of DHEA, and within a month, I think 40 or 50% managed to conceive. So they had a baby. In fact, I think they managed to carry it.
What was
So DHEA,
the strength?
6.5 milligrams single daily dose. That's nothing. And in fact, they measured the hormonal profile and showed that systemically they didn't affect the hormonal profile. So that was in so you're not gonna, because DHEA can convert to estrogen, right? So the concern is if you give a, but it's a low dose. At such a dose, and especially if it's a menopausal woman whose DHEA has already plummeted, you're basically replenishing DHEA back to youthful levels. And at 6.5 milligrams daily, it's very, very unlikely that is going to cause an estrogenic response, given that estrogen is already in the tissues. In fact, because in women, when used properly in proper amounts, DHEA converts predominantly to androgens, you're probably going to have like an anti-estrogenic effect overall, because about 30% of the DHEA you give to women on the labia is going to convert to testosterone. And testosterone is already used, especially by female endocrinological doctors, to improve sexual function in menopausal females. But they claim it's because it converts into estrogen, right? However, other studies have shown that if you give women dihydrotestosterone, which is a much stronger androgen and does not convert to estrogen, they basically become even more youthful and exuberant and, willing to meet up with men. So it's not the estrogen. It's really the estrogen, actually, if it accumulates and creates this balance of progesterone to estrogen. If you're in an estrogenic dominance, you'll either have basically no vitality whatsoever, or you'll be very, very on edge, agitated, incapable of relaxing, talking all the time, producing a very high number of words unprovoked. That's the other thing. Like the chatterbox, the infamous chatterbox, that every male tries to escape, that's a bad stereotype. That's a bad stereotype. That only happens when there's estrogenic dominance.
I mean, that was me my whole life. You just described me. I'm not that way anymore. I swear.
That's incredible. Raise your voice at me. Why are you yelling at me, right?
Oh, my goodness. Well, it's interesting because aromatization is like, that's like my middle name, or it was. And it just like anything. And I just will aromatize it into estrogen. It was crazy. But yeah, the cortisol, going back to that whole thing, that's what's going to happen when you're dominant, when your cortisol is running the show, isn't it? Is you're going
activates
to
the aromatize. That's what it does. And cortisol and estrogen almost always go together. That's why whenever a doctor tells me, well, if we want to improve bone health in a woman, we're going to give her estrogen. And I immediately think to myself, well, whenever you say estrogen, you should immediately as a doctor know that its twin brothers and sisters are prolactin and cortisol. So these two, no doctor denies that prolactin and cortisol are bad for the bone. In fact, there are warnings on the glucocorticoid medication that many people get for like arthritis or some chronic inflammatory condition. There's a black box warning. It says it can cause osteoporosis and osteopenia, even in non-menopausal women. So this is known. Prolactin is known to cause the exact same things. Somehow there's this disconnect between estrogen and its twin siblings, and it shouldn't be. They really all go together. These are the hormones of stress and repair. And then after they do their job, preferably quickly, then the differentiating factors such as progesterone with its anti-cortisol and anti-estrogenic effects can take over and basically restore balance. And it's the lack of restoration of balance really that's killing us, not just directly. All these hormones, they have their physiological purpose. They're there for a reason. Mm-hmm. But the fact that we lose our ability to control them with age is really what's causing all of these diseases. And now doctors say, you need more estrogen, more uncontrolled proliferation. No, DHEA will do just fine from most menopausal. I'll send you a study, very remarkable study. The women did not want to return their trial medication when they were giving it because they were feeling so well. They gave them these little, like, I don't know if it was suppositories or whatnot. So they were applying it, and the study, I think, was supposed to last a month. And then they said, okay, we're done. Please send us back like whatever leftover, because they always send more. Some of it is wasted. Maybe like you lose one flask or whatnot. And then I think the women refused. They said, no, I'm keeping it.
Over my dead body.
Exactly, yeah, for my cold dead hands.
What do we do about the estrogen that's in our body? Okay, so we take DHEA and things are great and we're feeling juicy and wonderful. And now what do we do about the estrogen in our body, in our tissues?
Progesterone kicks it out of the cell. Caffeine kicks it out of the cell. Aspirin kicks it out of the cell. Thyroid function basically makes the cell capable of dissociating estrogen from its receptor and basically flooding it into the bloodstream so it can get processed by the liver. And so since you don't want to just flood the liver and the bloodstream, because ultimately it goes to the liver. So if you suddenly flush all this estrogen out of your tissues, you can get a hyperestrogenic response. And I think some women have noticed that with higher dosages of progesterone, but not high enough in order to really like help the liver excrete the estrogen. So you can do it in a way that basically gets rid of estrogen, but not help enough for the liver to get rid of it. So you get this estrogen floating around and causing all these symptoms. So you want to help your liver, which means give the liver some niacinamide, because the liver excretion of estrogen, long time ago in the 60s, there was a study that showed it depends on vitamin B1, 2, and 3. So these three vitamins need to be in sufficient supply for the liver in order for the liver to be able to produce things like glucuronic acid or basically help the sulfatase enzymes attach sulfate groups to the estrogen and make it more water soluble so you can actually excrete it through the urine. So help your liver. Aspirin helps the liver as well. Progesterone helps the liver as well. Vitamin E helps the liver as well. Saturated fat helps the liver. Protein, sufficient protein. Do not be in a protein deficiency. Nothing really like messes up with the liver even a mild protein deficiency can do. And what is protein deficiency? Anything less than, I would say, 0.8 grams per kilogram of lean body mass. Used to be, I think Ray's recommendation was 1 gram per kilogram of body weight because it's easier to actually calculate. Mm-hmm. But since some of that body weight is fat mass, and fat doesn't have much of a use of a protein, in fact, it's going to oxidize this glucose, which is not a good thing. Mm-hmm. So basically 0.8. But I think that formula is not bad. Actually, 1 gram per kilogram of body weight is, and if you fall below that, especially if you're active, especially if you're doing like some kind of athletic thing, then you're going to be in a state of protein deficiency because all of your muscles need that protein, but so does your liver. I know many people don't think of the liver as needing protein, but the liver produces several proteins such as albumin and globulin, right? And various different ones like prothrombin. All of these are proteins. They're large proteins, but they're created from amino acids. And these amino acids can either come from your diet or come from muscle tissue. They should not be coming from muscle tissue. So eat your protein, take your aspirin, your coffee, to drink as much coffee as you'd like. Progesterone, yes. Well, without causing a stress reaction. Like I'm not, if you start getting
Caveat.
jittery, yeah, you overdid it.
Right. And then, of course, phase three detox, which is just supported the carrot salad and
Yes.
cascara sagrada and supporting elimination and feeding the estrobilome, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes, anything to speed up the bowel transit time. Basically, you don't want you don't it, after the food passes through your small intestine. In fact, after it passes through the upper third of the small intestine, everything after that you want to speed up as much as possible because any delay in emptying the bowel basically gives the opportunity of the bacteria that is naturally there, at least in the colon. But now lately, a lot of people have been noticing that the SIBO, small intestine bacterial overgrowth. I communicated with some doctors over email, and they told me when they were in medical school in the 70s and 80s, they learned that the small intestine is sterile. And that was the case back then. But now they're finding out that a mu increasing portion of the population, in fact, now a majority population, has bacterial overgrowth even in the small intestine. So really makes the very strong case for eating food that is extremely easily digestible, preferably if you can get absorbed in the stomach, and if not, the upper portion of the small intestine, because everything afterwards, chances are that it's colonized by bacteria, and whatever is not absorbed and utilized, it's going to become food for that bacteria, and you're going to give yourself an endotoxin slash inflammatory reaction.
Amazing. Yeah. Kiran Krishnan said that people have such low stomach acid these days that even just the, millions of bacteria that live in our mouths naturally are making their way into
End
the
up
small
there. Yep,
intestine.
yep, 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 yep. There's a great
Incredible.
study I can send you that shows that two groups. One was taking PPI drugs, and I think the other was not taking anything. At the start of the study, 6% of both groups on average had SIBO. Within 6 months of taking the PPI drugs, 72% of the PPI drug had SIBO because of the suppression
Of stomach acid.
of the stomach acid. Yeah.
Wow, that makes sense. Oh my goodness, this was just ridiculously good. Thank you so much. I
Thank
am
you.
so grateful. Okay, I didn't lie, did I? I did not lie. I literally had to edit out my scream at the end of that because I just had to scream, not scream, but just express my joy of how awesome that was. I hope that I was able to fit in. I had a lot of questions from people for him, but he answered a lot of them, if you noticed, on his own. And so I didn't have to go through my list. So I only had a handful of questions that were left that he didn't touch on. And then some of them I didn't ask, because I felt like we were kind of pressed for time. So, but yeah, I mean, I'm really looking forward to doing this whole test. Now, I have the luxury, of course, of getting the Dutch test just for cost for myself. I'm going to do the Moment test, which Alana Slingsby had sent to me quite a while ago. I hope I can still follow up on that wonderful gift that she gave me. But I was waiting for the right time, which is going to be probably in the next few weeks, so probably the next month, because I want to be working on this Kitty Bloomfield program for long enough that I have a groove, that I'm starting to eat pretty consistently, work out pretty consistently, that everything is feeling like I'm in the groove, right? Plus my Dr. Tyler Panzner program, if you guys remember, I had him do my genetic mutations, so my program has been tweaked to support the fact that I don't absorb vitamin D, the fact that I don't break down adrenaline, the fact that I have low L-histidine, all those things, my program is now perfected, I should say, to support everything. So that's really exciting. It's a place I've never been in my life. So what I want to do is continue to supplement my progesterone and my DHEA and do all the things that I'm doing, and then I want to go ahead and do the blood spot from Moment, a Dutch Complete dried urine, Georgie's steroid analysis, and go into go in for a full blood panel. So thyroid, prolactin, parathyroid, iron panel, all the things. And then I just want to combine them all and have all of that done within the same, you know, couple of weeks, and combine and look at it all in a big, huge format that Constantine doesn't know this yet, but he's going to help me to just put it in a way that we can all take a look at it and see. I mean, maybe you guys aren't looking forward to that, but I sure am. Not just for my own awareness, but also because I want to understand this estrogens going into the tissue in perimenopausal, menopausal women. And I want to understand if what I've been doing is helping to bring that estrogen out of the tissues and what it's all looking like. So I'm excited. I hope you're excited for me. And I hope you're looking forward to seeing those results. I still haven't done the episode I told you was just going to be me talking about my 40 days without any supplementation. I still have to do that. I promise you that is coming up very soon. So I want to just invite those of you who have the luxury of working with Kitty Bloomfield, because it's not cheap, but I honestly, guys, I had to save for this, like really, really save for this because it was not in our budget. I had to say for this, but I really think that it is going to be, and it is one of the most important things that I've taken on. I have struggled with stamina and my strength and my food. Even though it's my sort of specialty, I really drop the ball when it comes to counting macros, understanding if I'm getting enough to eat in a day, when I'm getting that, what kind of balance I'm, you know, getting, all of those things and how crucial they are to every waking and sleeping moment of your life, to every moment of your life. Are you getting enough fuel? Is it the right kind of fuel? Are you digesting that fuel? Are you converting that fuel? Are you eliminating the waste matter from that fuel effectively? Or are you recycling and creating endotoxin and all those dominoes that fall when we don't eat right, absorb right, and eliminate right? So this is going to be very exciting, and I would love to invite you guys to join me if you can. The information is in the show notes. The coupon code for my listeners and for the group is N as in Nancy, U as in umbrella, and the number 10, new 10 as in new strength 10. And it's a discount on all her programs except for the 7-day challenge. And yeah, I want you guys to join me because I don't want to do this alone. I want to hear from you. I want you to come in the group and tell me what's going on. And I'm going to start sharing more lives, more videos, and I'm going to have Kitty Bloomfield on a live in the Estrogen Dominant Support Group coming up very soon. And for those of you who have been asking about the Mighty Network, the Healthy Gut Girls Mighty Network, it is up and running. It is very daunting. I will not lie to you. You know, we're almost at 30,000 people on Facebook, and it's like really active group. And it's just, I'm scared that nobody's going to want to come over. But and it's not as robust yet as Facebook, but it's going to be, and it's going to be a lot more organized. So if you want to look up Healthy Gut Girls Mighty Network, you can certainly join. It's a private group. You can certainly join, and I will certainly accept you. And you can watch it grow with me. You can be part of the beginnings. So going back to Georgie Dinkoff, that message, that information is also in the show notes. And if you go, if you click on that link for his Idea Labs, you're going to come to a little page that has three lines. It says categories, and then another little side thing will come up, and you'll see lab, R&D chemicals, cosmetic ingredients, and you'll see bioanalysis. And if you click on bioanalysis, you're going to see the three labs that he offers: the mineral analysis, the steroid analysis, and the thyroid analysis. And the steroid analysis is the one that's going to show you all of your sex hormones, your androgens, your cortisol, all of that stuff. And the basic, it's slightly confusing. The basic test is $74.99, but that is just to process it. So you have to go down below and you have to pick which things you want tested from the tissue samples that you send in. And from that, you'll see, like, you know, if you want your androgen. So I'm going to get my, you know, my, here, I'll open it so I can just guide you through what I'm going to do. So I'm going to do hair, not nails, because I always wear nail polish and have had gel nails in the past and acrylic nails. I just don't want to mess with that. And it doesn't seem like it gives you quite as much info anyway, that's as much as the hair. So I'm going to do the precursors, pregnenolone, progesterone. I'm going to do the androgens, which includes your testosterone, and I'm going to do the estrogens, which includes all three estrogens, and then the mineral glucocorticoids. So that's all your cortisol. Those are the ones I'm going to do, and I think that that is going to end up, I think, being close to $500, guys. So it isn't cheap, but it's just like the Dutch. It's one of these things where we have to, and no, I'm not getting a discount. I would share it with you if I were. So, and I want to support Georgie anyway. He's getting this off the ground. It is going to be, he's making history, friends. I promise you, medical history here. He's making some historical, you know, research is being done here. And so I just want to support that in every possible way that I can. And so I'm just going to have to, you know, budget it in, start saving again, like I did for Kitty's program. Okay, I've spoken enough. I hope you enjoyed that. Everything is in the show notes, guys. Please follow Kitty Bloomfield. Please support Georgie at heydudediet.me. You're going to see that in the show notes as well. That's his forum, his website, and it's filled with so much research and incredible information and data and literature and citations and everything. You have to support that. And you must. And what else? Yeah. Okay. I think that's everything, friends. All right. Talk to you soon. Yay!